Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
As all of you know, May is essentially the big season for sports. You got the NHL playoffs, you got the NBA playoffs, you got Major League Baseball, go Cubs, and many more. There's a ton of action, but there's only one place that has you covered and only one place that we trust to actually place the bets that matter, and that is betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use that promo code podcast1 for your 50% welcome bonus. You know, I love seeing individuals compete in athletics at the very highest level. Now, mind you, if someone could please beat the Golden State Warriors, that would be so fulfilling to me. It just seems that there's nothing good that happens out of this sort of NBA climate. But kind of seeing Golden State go against Houston, I just love seeing the James Harden versus Kevin Durant dynamic. These former teammates now in this really amazing setting. Love it. However, it's kind of evident that I think Golden State will prevail. But if you want to actually place a bet for or against Golden State, you can do so by going to betonline.ag. Don't sit on the sidelines anymore. Get in on the action. Don't forget to use that promo code podcast1 or text BETNOW. That's bet now to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. Again, that is betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts. Welcome, everybody, to the first live show of the Charlie Kirk Show here at the Turning Point USA World Headquarters at the Freedom Center in Phoenix, Arizona. We are so excited to be here in the heart of liberty. I'm originally from Illinois. The fun thing about being from Illinois is we have term limits in Illinois, except different type of term limits, one term in office, one term in jail. So a little different than most states. But being in Arizona, a state that works, a state with low taxes, that embraces free enterprise, we're happy to be here in this freedom-loving, honestly, center of free enterprise and just where everything is entrepreneurial focused and on risk-taking. And it's a fitting area for Turning Point USA to be headquartered in this amazing, liberty-loving state. And our staff has just Turning Point USA does an amazing job every single day to grow chapters and to do the work on college campuses every single day. So we're going to be taking questions. We're going to be having some fun, having a conversation. And I think we got a question back here.
Well, in Arizona, there's a huge number of Latinos. And I, for one, I am a Latino. And when it comes to Latinos and going to college and jobs, there's this one thing that's called affirmative action. What is your views on affirmative action and what may a conservative defend or even debunk affirmative action?
Great question. Thank you. So I get this question a lot. So the kind of the common talking point is that affirmative action is reverse racism. It's not reverse racism. It is racism. If you're judging people based on their skin color, it is a form of racism. And what's so frustrating is that in the 1960s, Martin Luther King talked about creating a country where we judge people on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And now somehow people are being rewarded or punished based solely on the color of their skin. See, we should judge people on acceptance to universities or in places of work based on things that you can control, based on character and work ethic and productivity. Things you can't control, such as the melanin in your skin, should not be a determinator based on college acceptance. And you know who it really negatively harms affirmative action is Asian American students. Asian American students are actually, they have to get higher SAT scores. They have to get higher test scores when they go to schools such as Harvard. And there's a huge lawsuit right now against Harvard on behalf of Asian American students to go into Harvard. And I think what's really kind of the deeper point of this, though, is the rise of identity politics in America. I mean, you have people on the Democrat side right now, people on the American left, that say we should not have a president that is a straight white male. I don't care if it's a straight white male. I don't care if it's Pete Buttigieg. I actually said his name right, actually, right? Did I say his name right? I don't care if it's a woman. I don't care if it's a man. I care if you're qualified to be president of the United States. I care if you have character. I care most importantly, actually, if you have really good ideas or bad ideas. And that's the type of country that America was always in the direction of being. And now we're going in the opposite direction. We're actually descending in a direction away from the most aspirational foundational values. See, you can make the argument that the Civil Rights Act was made Americans more free, that we're actually going in the direction of increasing liberties and freedoms of all people. Because before the Civil Rights Act, we did not have the type of freedoms that we enjoy today. Now some of the policies that are being advocated by the American left will actually make us more divided and less free, that we're actually going in the opposite direction that the heroes marched for in the Civil Rights Act. And I would love to live in a country where you could not judge somebody's political preference based on their skin color. How many of you have done this? You immediately think based on someone's skin color, maybe not consciously, maybe subconsciously. Boy, it would be a difficult thing to believe if this person was a conservative. That's all of us doing prejudice based on somebody, right? We've almost been programmed that, oh boy, just I don't know if this person's a conservative. Unless they bring out a Make America Great Again hat, you're like, wow, that's so amazing. I'd love to live in a country you can't guess someone's political affiliation, that you have to have a conversation with somebody, that it's value-based, not skin color-based. And this kind of affirmative action policy that unfortunately has been upheld by the Supreme Court in recent years, a variation of it, not as explicit as being argued against in Harvard, is racism. And it's divisive. And it pits people against each other. And honestly, in the words of Clarence Thomas, it allows the bigotry of low expectations to seep into the black community, where somehow it's saying that Hispanic Americans or black Americans aren't smart enough to be able to get the same grades, the same test scores as others. That's so insulting, isn't it? To say that certain communities need even more government help or need more top-down central planning to help them. That's looking at people way too monolithically, isn't it? That somehow all black people are the same, or all Hispanics are the same. Now, the argument that is made, though, to kind of play devil advocate against myself, is, well, what about institutional racism against these groups? What against the systemic policies that have been pitted against them? What a dangerous path that is to go down there. First of all, tell me why affirmative action, which helps black Americans or African Americans, should help someone who just recently immigrated from Nigeria, from a royal family in Nigeria, or helps the son of Colin Powell, or helps the daughter of Condoleezza Rice, for example, or Michael Jordan's son. Affirmative action, by definition, would help them, even though they grew up in a, quote-unquote, very privileged society, right? A very privileged upbringing, I should correct myself, because they grew up with a lot of wealth. That kind of breaks the argument that skin color is, by definition, the primary indicator of somebody's success. But even more than that, unfortunately in America, our past shows that as a country, we have discriminated against all sorts of different groups, not just black Americans. There is racism against Irish Americans. 10,000 Chinese Asian Americans worked to build the Transcontinental Railroad in the American West, which was basically slavery. 10,000 Chinese Americans. So I'm really scared that if we start to pick and choose different groups that were worse off or more abused, because slavery was a form of abuse. It was one of the worst sins humanity ever committed, was the sin of slavery. All of a sudden, we're going to get into a competition, almost an Olympic competition, of which group was most oppressed. And so can someone explain this to me? So the reparations argument has come up now on the Democrat side. Can someone explain to me what happens if someone is half black and half white, and half their ancestors owned slaves and the other half were slaves? Do they pay themselves? Is that kind of how it works? They have to like send a check addressed to themselves? Now, in the words of some very, very wise black conservative commentators like Larry Elder, we love Larry Elder, right? He says, wait a second. The left has said for years that it is racist to demand anyone has to show a photo ID, right? That this is a racist thing. So wait a second. Then please tell me how, if you think it's racist to show a photo ID, what is it to say that someone has to prove their ancestry 8 generations back? I mean, they can't find a photo ID, but they somehow can get the paperwork together to prove that they were 8 generations away, that their family was slaves. The improbability of it is so absurd. Instead, what we should be talking about is, how do we expand opportunity? How do we expand liberty for anyone that might be currently disaffected? And by the way, I think that anyone that owned slaves should be put in prison right now. Anyone. We should all applaud for that, right? Anyone that owns slaves should be put in prison. If you can find me someone that has owned slaves, they should be put in prison. For life, no parole, no chance of getting out. Anyone that advocates for slavery should have something held against them. I don't find those people today. Do you? Those are so many generations away. Can you find anyone that knew anyone that owned a slave? Maybe if you find a 97-year-old person. Maybe. We are so far removed from that sin of our country. In fact, we marched in the streets against it. We marched against Democrats, by the way. The Democrats were the ones that owned the slaves in this country. It was the Democrats that formed the KKK, which was an extension of the American Confederacy, to go against the American blacks. It was the Republican Party that was founded in 1860 as a single-issue party, an anti-slavery party. In Ripon, Wisconsin, I probably mispronounced it. Ripon, I always mispronounce it. Ripon, Ripon, whatever. Wisconsin, as an anti-slavery party in 1860, a single-issue party, as an abolitionist party. Now, what's the continuity here? Because I'm sure you guys hear all the time, well, the parties never switched. You guys heard this before, right? Or maybe they did switch. What did they say? No, the parties switched. That's what they say, right? The party switched, and the Democrats became the Republicans, and the Republicans became the Democrats. What are they really saying? What they're saying is, well, Abraham Lincoln was actually a Democrat in today's time because he was a good guy, and the Confederacy was actually Republicans because they were bad guys. That's what they're really saying, right? Is that good and bad, because Democrats are somehow good today. That's what they're really trying to say. Well, hold on. If this argument had any merit, why is it as the American South got increasingly less racist? Because we can all agree the American South is less racist today than it was in the 1960s. Why did it get more Republican? Why did it, as the Republican values got moved into the South, less racist ideas came with it? It should have been the exact opposite. If Democrat values were that of not being racist, then the American South should have stayed Democrat. There should have been no correlation between the two. But it's much more nuanced than this. Because if you actually look at Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1952 election, Dwight D. Eisenhower in the 1956 election, he won several Southern states. This idea of the Southern Democrat dominance throughout the 40s and 50s and 60s is just not true. Is that there were many Republicans, anti-racist Republicans such as Dwight D. Eisenhower, who brought in the Little Rock Nine to desegregate the Arkansas schools, that stood against Southern Democrats. It was Southern Democrats. So what's the continuity, though? What's the connection? Because obviously the modern-day Democrats don't advocate for the same policies back then, right? The one word. It's about control. It's about control. The 1960s Democrats were focused on controlling people, weren't they? The 2019 Democrats are focused on controlling people, aren't they? The 1865 Democrats were focused on controlling people. What were the 1860 Republicans focused on? Liberation. What were the 1960s Republicans focused on? Liberation. Where are the 2019 Republicans focused on? Liberation. If that's the continuity, is that Republicans have always been, how do we improve certain people's lives that might be in less than desirable circumstances by increasing their freedom? Democrats have always been about, how do we keep certain people in their circumstance, currently in that same circumstance, so that we can politically control them? They have not changed. The philosophical line remains current from the 1860s to today. Now, there's been some nuance, and there was minor party switches and defections, so on and so forth, but this is one of the biggest lies of the American left. Thank you for your question. We'll get to the next one now.
My question is regard to fatherhood. Fatherhood is shifting and evolving. So what would you say is the future of fatherhood, and how do we kind of bring it back to this higher calling or this great responsibility?
It's a great question. So thank you. So the importance of fathers, and I mean, look, first of all, this is why I take such a strong stand on what people consider to be a superfluous issue as when I say there are only two genders. This is why this is so important. Because gender roles matter, and gender and sex are directly related. Because as soon as you start to deteriorate the idea that gender and sex are directly related, what you're really saying is the nuclear family does not matter. The family unit is the most proven cultural institution in human history. It's more proven than even the church, believe it or not. It's older than the church. It's older than synagogues. It's older than anything else. The idea of having a mother and father working as a team cooperatively with different roles, different strengths, different weaknesses, different abilities to solve problems, to be able to, first and foremost, survive. That's what the family unit used to be all about, is survival. Secondly, to be able to raise children with good ethics. And thirdly, be able to pass on whatever values or wealth you have to future generations. What I'm really afraid of today is that there's two really big lies being taught to young people. There's lies being taught to women. There's lies being taught to men. So let me tell you the lies being taught to women. And I'm going to be careful not to deal in absolutism, because I don't like that. But there is absolutes being taught to young women. Young women, more times than not, are taught that marriage is something that they should avoid, that they should put career first. Now, of course, there's exceptions to this. There's people that decide to pursue career, and that's the right choice for them. But the data shows that more and more young women have less favorable views of getting married and having children because the media, the culture, and academia are short-selling the bedrock institution of getting married and having children. This is why I believe that you have hyper-successful women in their 30s that are some of the least happy people in America. And the data shows this. The happiness index shows women that are unbelievably successful. They're partners in law firms. They have their own businesses. Yet their happiness index is missing. Well, that's, you can make the biological argument that women should be having children at some point. Now, there are women that decide not to. And good for them. They should have that freedom to do that. And we support that totally and completely. But large in part, women are much more effective nurturers and caretakers than men are. And I'm afraid that women are being sold this huge lie that somehow you can find the highest level of happiness and fulfillment as the rule, not the exception rule, because there's always exceptions. And there's women that do find that happiness and do find that fulfillment. And they should have the freedom and liberty to do that. But generally, the rule is that getting married matters and having children matters. So that's one of the big lies. And there's the lies being taught to men. And the lies being taught to men is somehow that you don't need to act responsibly. That somehow you can just act recklessly. Recklessness versus responsibility is a huge lie being taught to young men. And it really gets ingrained in, I think, the hyper-feminization of our education system. School is built for women. It is not built for men right now. The way that our elementary school and our high schools are built. And there's a great, great, great essay on this by Christine Hoff Summers, who she talks about young boys are just more restless. They need more time outside. They need more time to create. They need more time to do things with their hands. Young ladies mature quicker, first and foremost. They like to read more. They're much more, the type of academic environment that a young woman flourishes in and prospers in is completely different than one that a young man or a developing man prospers in. So what ends up happening is our culture glorifies the idea of seeking thrills at a very young age, especially for young men, at almost no responsibility cost. And I'm afraid college plays into this in the worst possible sense. And what happens over time is young men find that there's very little fulfillment in just thrill seeking. There's very little fulfillment in just binge drinking to oblivion and getting passed out drunk too many times or pursuing drugs or not taking responsibility for yourself. So you have these two extremes that have now become, unfortunately, the predominance of our generation. And this is where you get the opioid epidemic. And this is also where you get, unfortunately, the rise of women that look to men as the problem in society. And it really should be a partnership that I'm going to say something that should not be controversial. Men are better at some things than women, and women are better at some things than men. And this should not be a wildly controversial statement that, in fact, a functioning society recognizes these differences, celebrates these differences, and understand that in leadership and that in culture, both of those must exist cohesively and cooperatively. So thank you for the question. We'll get to the next one. So, getting fit and staying healthy always sounds easier said than done, right? OpenFit is bringing you something new that makes it even easier to never miss a workout. Lose the commute to the gym and let the workouts come to you. OpenFit takes all of the complexity out of losing weight and getting fit. It's a brand new, super simple streaming service. I honestly just promoted it the other day. It's really amazing. I'm always traveling. I'm traveling 340 days a year. I'm using it with some of my stretches. I'm actually recuperating from a back injury right now. So I have some of the yoga and some of the stretches that are in there. I was running all the time and working out. Once on my road to recovery, OpenFit is going to help me get there. I'll tell you right now, all out of the comfort of my living room or my hotel room, wherever it might be. There's amazing trainers and classes, interactive. So you're able to actually get coaching. You're able to get encouragement while you're doing it. It's really, really simple. The app is easy to use. You just understand it as soon as you open it. Access it anywhere at any time. View on your computer. It's web-enabled, TV, tablet, smartphone, and Roku. It's results you can see. You can track it. You can set goals. Lose up to 15 pounds in just the first 30 days. Flatten your abs and shape your body. Look and you'll feel great. And I'll tell you, again, for the stretching and things that I'm doing, it keeps me disciplined. I get alerts. I get push notifications. It keeps me accountable. It allows me to do the type of workouts that I need to do on my personal road to recovery and eventually be able to work out the way that I used to.
So OpenFit has just changed the way I've worked out. With my promo code KIRK, that is K-I-R-K, you can join me on a fitness journey personalized just for you. Again, use my code KIRK, K-I-R-K, and start using OpenFit for your journey to start a healthier life. Right now, during the OpenFit 30-Day Challenge, my listeners get a special extended 30-day trial membership to OpenFit, where you can lose up to 15 pounds in 30 days when you text KIRK, K-I-R-K, to 303030. Again, that's 303030. That's three 30s in a row. You'll get access to OpenFit, all the workouts and nutrition information totally free. Again, just text KIRK, K-I-R-K, to 303030. Standard message and data rates may apply.
I was actually holding the microphone at the AASU Campus Clash, and one of the girls asked about the children being detained.
Yes.
I think the question she wanted to ask was, how can Turning Point be against big government but not push for evaluating the children that are saying that they're being sexually exploited and raped?
Sure.
So what is your perspective on that?
Thank you for the question. So anyone that commits any sort of crime, whether they be an ICE officer or a private citizen, should be held to the highest and most brutal interpretation of our standards. What I mean by brutal is that I have no leniency in my own interpretation of someone that sexually assaults a minor, whether it be an ICE agent, a Border Patrol agent, or an individual. I've not found anyone that finds that to be excusable behavior. However, just recently, there was a huge discovery by ICE that there's a rent-a-child policy now. For $150, you can now rent a child to cross the border. And so the idea behind the family separations was this. There are people that are crossing the southern border with people that are not their children. That's a hard thing to talk about. It's not popular. It's really hard to articulate on cable news. But it's happening, where there are people that are crossing the southern border where they're either smuggling children or they're renting children. Boy, are those horrific things, aren't they? Those are evil things, too. And so the thought process was, and it's not a perfect, it's not, by no means perfect, because we have a calamity and we have a crisis on our border. So it's, how can we limit and minimize the amount of children that are first and foremost being sex trafficked into our country? So what they did is they said, let's separate the people that are coming across the border. And what do? They say, what are your parents' names? And then they go to the parents, say, what are your children's names? And as soon as those don't add up, you got a problem, right? Then they can do DNA sampling. They can do base 5 questions. You can find for any logical and rational questioner, you can find that this child's being sex trafficked or not. Now, the idea that there were children in cages is just not true. There are not children in cages at the southern border. That was happening in previous administrations. Obama administration. It was. The ICE facilities at the southern border are actually above average. They're quite luxurious. If you actually go and visit an ICE facility, they have ping pong tables, video games, cable television, Wi-Fi, and air conditioning. Now, the evil people that abuse children should be put in prison and throw away the key. They should never see the light of day. And I think, unfortunately, the conversations that's demagogued that somehow I'm apologizing for those people. Of course not. I would never apologize for the abuse or for the targeting of children in any capacity whatsoever. But I will not apologize for a policy that is designed to stop child sex trafficking, because I can't think of any more institutionalized evil practice in our country to bring a 9-year-old girl for the sole purpose to sell that girl into basically modern day sex slavery. And there are thousands and thousands of children where that's the case right now, where they know no different. And until we have some form of preventative measure, henceforth a wall, that's what I'm going to call it now, a preventative measure, maybe the wall, maybe the left will start supporting it if I call it a preventative measure, right? They're big into preventative medicine, you know, preventative this, preventative that. So preventative measure to stop smugglers, to stop border jumpers, to stop line cutters from bringing in drugs and child sex trafficking children. I'm not going to apologize for having someone temporarily separated from the person they crossed with at that southern border. And I believe far too often we get into this cycle of assuming the media narrative, and we get too into the trap that somehow what they are saying is absolutely and totally clear. And for those of you that have not had the opportunity to visit the southern border, I encourage you to do it. Talk to the ranchers. Talk to the people up front. They will tell you that this is an absolute crisis at the southern border. And this is why Donald Trump's approval rating has skyrocketed amongst the Hispanic community. Because the Hispanic community that came here legally and obeyed the law, they know that there's a serious problem right now at the southern border. And there is no easy fix. I believe that there needs to be some form of a barrier, wall, whatever you want to call it, with a legal immigration solution that will allow the people that did not consciously commit a crime, henceforth DACA recipients, be able to stay here humanely and effectively, while also be able to lock down on the horrific people that have taken advantage of a porous southern border over the years. So thank you for the question. So, other questions? Yes.
Okay. So my original question was more so to the detention centers, not illegal immigration.
Sure.
I completely agree with your points.
Yeah.
But it's more so because that is a big government department institution. How can we change the people that are currently working for the ICE and Border Patrol departments that are exploiting the children? So I'm not saying traffickers.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying U.S. employees.
So anyone that commits those crimes should be put in prison. And I think we should have, like all government agencies, the capacity to fire anyone that doesn't do their job. So I would – and this – I don't believe in government unions. So I think public sector unions, which Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a Democrat president, warned against public sector unions. So I don't – I can only imagine how difficult it is to fire an ICE agent that doesn't do his or her job. So that person should be fired immediately if they don't do their job. So same with a Border Patrol agent, or same with someone that works for the Department of Agriculture. We should be able to fire government workers a lot more easily and effectively. And I support that government-wide. You bet. Thank you.
2020 is going to be the most important election in our nation's history. Seriously. President Trump and the RNC have already posted record fundraising numbers and assembled an outstanding staff. But now they're asking for your help to build the winning grassroots support network. Text CHARLIE to 88022 and receive official Trump alerts directly to your phone. I get these all the time, by the way. They are when they have rallies, when there's big news, when they need certain things pushed out. You guys have to sign up. You'll gain exclusive insight from President Trump himself, be the first to know when Trump merchandise is available, and you'll even be able to give your input on key issues to help shape the 2020 campaign. I know the leadership of the Trump campaign. They read these. They love to hear from the grassroots. All you have to do is text CHARLIE to 88022. Look, we all know by now that the mainstream media will never be honest about President Trump and Republicans. Make sure you're getting your news directly from the source by texting CHARLIE to 88022. Again, be sure to text CHARLIE to 88022 today. This is paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again.
Yes. We currently live in the time where conservatives are constantly being censored by big tech companies like Facebook and Twitter because of their values and beliefs. So what is the most ethical and practical solution in curing this problem, which I'm currently writing a blog post about this. So what would be your solution to this?
This is such a hot issue, and thank you for asking it.
Oh, no problem.
It's a really complicated issue, so I'm going to let you guys walk through it with me because I believe I know the path forward, but I'm really hesitant to say it's 100% the correct thing to do because it involves things that at times flex my principles up against the wall a little bit. So right now, by any definition, Google is a monopoly. 85% of all search results go through Google. I guarantee you all of you use Google at least once a week. If not, you use YouTube, which is owned by Google. Secondly, Facebook. Now, mind you, I do have to say that I use these sites and I've benefited from those sites. So I'm the first one to say that. I understand that. So I want to be very careful and very nuanced and not come across as hypocritical and not come across as cavalier as some of these other people do where we have to say, just blow it all up. And I think it has to be a lot more nuanced than that. Okay? So I've benefited from Instagram. I've benefited from Facebook. I've benefited from Twitter. I've benefited from Google and all these different channels. But there is an issue happening here. And without a doubt, there is blatant viewpoint discrimination that is happening on these channels, whether it be the censoring of big figures that might have a difference of opinion from the status quo of Silicon Valley, or just the small, subtle silencing that happens to, I'm sure, a lot of people in this room, where you like a post and you come back and it's not liked anymore, or you see your favorite person doesn't show up in your newsfeed anymore, right? Because they kind of get delisted. Shadow banning, which is something that has been admitted to on camera. That's the soft silencing of that. So there's definitely an issue. Mind you, don't hear this ever happening to leftists. You don't ever hear the big leftists getting deplatformed, even though there are people on Twitter that call for the open death of me, of President Trump. It seems like they don't get deplatformed or delisted. I think that's a really big problem. Now, mind you, this is a problem because basically they are monopolies. So here's my thought exercise for you guys. I'm going to tell you where I'm currently leaning, but I'm open for my mind to be changed. Because that's my one piece of advice. Always be open for other ideas. Always. Be open for discourse and dialogue. So they are a monopoly. So the Milton Friedman School of Monopolies are the best way to crush monopolies is through competition, right? Is through more people taking risk, more entrepreneurs challenging them. I find agreement with all of that. I really do. However, I'm waiting. And do I realistically think someone can compete against Google at this point in time? The answer is I don't know, probably not. The amount of dominance they have on search engines, the dominance they have on videos, the dominance they have on email, the dominance they have on information processing. It's going to be hard for anyone to be able to have that same sort of market share that they have. And they have a 50-year, 100-year vision for their company. And they've only started growing. So the second thing is this, the kind of the parallel, the juxtaposition is, so that's the free market side of me, which obviously is the biggest and most predominant because that's who I am, right? So I want to see conservative Mark Zuckerberg take a risk and take him down, right? That's what we believe in. That's who we are. But at the same time, there's something very dangerous in argumentation that we should never get ourselves trapped into, to believe that the times that we're living in today are the times that we've lived in previously. Because I believe this actually might be a unique circumstance. It might be. It might be a time where these companies have become pseudo untouchable entities. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we can see a great defection from Instagram. Do you think that's realistic? Maybe not. Because I think that right now they have such a monopolization on the feed of information that it's going to be tough for anyone to compete them in the foreseeable future. Now, here's the problem, is that they are monopolies. So by any interpretation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, which says that there should not be monopolies, they should be broken up. ExxonMobil would not be allowed to have 85% of search results. They just wouldn't. Walmart would not be able to have 85% of all low-cost retail shopping. This is tough, and I'm going to admit to my audience, this is tough, guys. I don't want to be able to say, send the government after them. That's not who we are, right? That's not who we are at all. And so there has to be a balance. And there has to be an equilibrium. So this is my first step. I'll say any company that engages in blatant viewpoint discrimination, such as we've seen recently, they should be barred from competing against any federal contract. I think that's a good entry point because we've seen it work already with the executive order on free speech on college campuses, where President Trump signed that heroic free speech executive order. And we've already seen things at Turning Point USA change on the front lines, the way they treat us when they come on campus, more Turning Point USA groups now getting approved, people that are getting treated better. So I think that's a good first step. And I'm going to search far and wide, everywhere I can, for a free market-based solution before we have to say, send the den of lions of government after them, because that's not who we principally are. However, I am admitting to my audience and admitting to all of you, I'm afraid we're closer to that point than we ever want to be comfortable with, because these companies, in some ways, are more powerful than the federal government. They're more powerful than agencies of the federal government. It is our own military that depends on information that is provided by these tech companies. It is our own government that is housed on servers that is owned by these tech companies. It's our own government that relies on the chatter and the communication that comes from these tech companies. And so we might be a lot closer than a lot of us realize. So stay very aware, always stay principled. This is going to be a very, very difficult issue moving forward, and I appreciate the question. Thank you. All right, other questions? Anything? Oh, hi, Taylor.
Hey there. Hey, you mentioned unions, and I want to kind of talk a little bit about teachers' unions and rubber rooms. And
you remember that, my talks.
That, you know, so I've known Charlie for a hot minute now, and one of the first things that Charlie really, not changed my mind on, but like helped me realize where I stood as a conservative, was on school choice.
Thank you.
And I feel like there's a lot of conservatives who don't understand school choice and why it's important. So can you talk a little bit about that using rubber rooms?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Taylor, because there's things I talk about years ago, and then I get tired of hearing myself say these things So then I stopped talking about them, even though I don't realize that other audiences haven't heard about that in a while. I don't think I've talked about rubber rooms in like a year and a half. Yeah, so thank you. Okay, so let me walk you through this, guys, if you guys haven't heard of this before. So I believe that we as a society have now matured to a point where that we have engaged in the funding of public education. Whether we like it or not, that's the way it is. So therefore, we are engaging in the funding of public education. It is a moral catastrophe that children, and predominantly minority Black children and Hispanic children, are subject to these failing public schools. We have to do better. I believe it's the civil rights issue of our time. I truly believe that. Because if a student cannot read, if someone cannot speak, if someone cannot process information, they cannot be someone that is a functioning member of our society. Okay? That's honestly what's happening at a lot of these schools. So I believe that we have done absolute disservice to the least of these through public education. And the Democrats own this issue time and time again. They say, oh, we care about education. We want to throw more money at it. One of my laws, one of my rules that I have in politics, you'll get to know this, just because someone wants to throw more money at it does not mean it's going to get better, and it doesn't mean they care about it. This is something Republicans do all the time. Well, we have funded the military with the most money ever. So what? You're probably wasting more money now than ever before. Just because you're spending more money on something does not mean that the program's going to work better, and it doesn't mean you actually care about the end result. Never allow the left to lay that trap for you. Well, XYZ now has funded schools more than ever before. Well, have test scores gone up? Have literacy rates increased? Has gang violence decreased? Well, no, but we're funding more money. Well, it doesn't mean anything. You could fund the money and burn the money in a wheelbarrow on the roof, and it doesn't mean anything. So that's the one thing. The Democrats always talk about funding when it comes to education, when funding is not actually the greatest predictor of a child's success. Funding in a school is not the greatest predictor. It's down there for a fifth. You know what the number one predictor is of a child's likelihood to go to college, not enter gangs? The number one predictor by an unbelievable multiple is the quality of teacher. It's not class size. It's not the size of the school. It's not even what class they're taking. It is the quality of the teacher by far. It is the most important thing. And think about it. Think back to your own education. Was it not the most engaging, entertaining, empathetic teacher that you looked forward to the class to the most? It could have been the most boring subject, right? It could have been math, which math and I never got along, right? It's just, I was okay at it. I was actually pretty good at it. Just whatever reason, it was just not something. Now, social studies and history, I always loved, right? Those are my favorite. I have a feeling there's a lot of those. If you're here tonight, you probably loved social studies and history. But the quality of the teacher, no matter what it was, for me, was what got me the most excited about going to that class. That the most retention that I had and the best that I did was the teacher that woke up the earliest, that was there before I got there, that took the least amount of sick days, that cared about grading my papers. Now, I have a unique perspective. I went to what was called gifted school in Chicago, kindergarten, first, and second grade. I went to Christian school, third, fourth, and fifth grade. Then I went to public school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, and then public high school. So I've seen it all, if you will. I've seen the gifted school, the Christian-based school, and the public school. And from my time in public education, I'll never forget this. I went to one of my teachers, and she was so amazing. And I'm not going to say her name because then she'll probably get flooded with all these things. And it's almost impossible to fire teachers. This might actually fire. So she was unbelievable. I'll never forget her. She got in every morning at 6:15 a.m. School started at 7:20, way too early. By the way, that's one of the stupidest things to have early. Honestly, if they backed it up to 8:30, kids' lives would be better. It's actually data behind this, which is these early start times is one of the stupidest things ever. Anyway, 6:15, she would get in, always grading the papers. She'd have a policy that she would grade a test within one day. It's amazing. She'd always respond to email. Like, her life was this class, and she was teaching AP U.S. History. She was amazing. I learned so much from her. It was my favorite class I ever took. And she wasn't even a conservative. She was a liberal, not a leftist. But she never let her politics seep into the classroom. She was open to other ideas. It was exactly what education should be. And she cared. And then there was this dolt a couple doors down. And this guy was not a good person. No, he wasn't. He was insulting. He was boorish. He was rude. He would show up late. He wouldn't grade any papers. He couldn't care less. We watched nonsensical movies. And then I started, when I got my junior year, which was when I was taking AP US History, and I started to research what teachers were making in my local area. Now, mind you, before I hear the gasps in the room, we have some of the highest compensated teachers in the country. So this dolt, to put it nicely, was earning $138,000 a year. $138,000 a year. That doesn't count the pension. And this unbelievably committed AP US History teacher that could not have been more engaging. I had a question about the 1917 income tax. She would come with the next day with literally like professor level research ready to talk to me about the income tax. I had a question about General MacArthur. She would just educate herself so she could educate her students. Like the most amazing tutor. And honestly, part of the reason that I got so on fire about our country was because of how well she taught our history. And that obviously led to Turning Point USA. Public teacher. She was earning $41,000 a year. Now, that's a good wage for most teachers throughout the country, obviously higher standard of living. But look at the difference. You had this imbecile. And I don't say that lightly. This guy was so mean, and it was a reputation for it. But he was tenured. Couldn't fire him. In fact, many times the administration tried to remove him, and he invoked the teacher unions, and he invoked lawyers, and he was impossible to fire. And yet, this amazing AP US History teacher, no matter what she did, no matter how early she showed up, no matter how late she stayed, she could not get a pay increase. Because that's the way our screwed up public education system is designed. It does not matter how good of a teacher you are. It doesn't matter how early you show up. It doesn't matter how educated your kids become. It matters how long you've been there. Are you kidding me? That's a horrible way to compensate teachers. That's a backwards way to ever reward success. And this is a byproduct of the public sector teacher unions. The public sector teacher unions are one of the greatest impediments to minority children's success in this country. There are two big institutions, the National Education Association, the NEA, and the American Federation of Teachers, the AFT. I want to make myself perfectly clear. I'm against teacher unions. I'm so pro-teacher. I'm on fire for teachers. Teachers are modern day heroes. We need smarter people to go into teaching. We need more ethical people to go into teaching. We need teachers to be paid more money. We need teachers to be making $200,000, $300,000 a year. My AP US History teacher could have done the job of that imbecile plus her own salary. Easily, they could have combined the classes and she could have done it because she was on fire. There's nothing that could have stopped her. Yet she was stuck in this bureaucratic mess. And I saw it happen firsthand. So what ends up happening is in these really deteriorating, poor, horrible schools, the worst teachers get paid the exact same as the best teachers. So for anyone listening to this and you have dreams, you're thinking to yourself, well, why would I want to be a teacher? Why would I want to do that? Especially, why would I want to be a public school teacher? Maybe go to charter schools where they reward teachers if they work harder and they do well. You definitely want to become a public teacher, public school teacher, because you're like, I actually want to pursue excellence. I want to be the best teacher ever. That's not the place for you. So then here's what ends up happening. Is unfortunately, underqualified people end up becoming teachers. And there are underqualified people in our society. We just have to have this conversation. That there are people that are getting education degrees and getting teaching certificates that have no business getting teaching certificates. And I was taught by a lot of them. And they were overcompensated, underqualified, and undermotivated. And they were overpaid. And so I believe in something that Barack Obama ran for president on back in 2008. That good teachers should be paid more and bad teachers should be fired. This is something that should be talked about every single day. Because the quality of the teacher will change the fabric of this country. If we have more good teachers, we'll have a better country. We get rid of bad teachers, we'll have a better country. Yet, the only thing that is preventing this is public sector teacher unions. They have a thing called tenure, and they will defend to the death a bad teacher from being fired. And that's where we get things called rubber rooms. A rubber room is a physical place. There's one in downtown Chicago. There's one in Detroit. There's one in New York. Big urban cities usually have them. A rubber room is a place where there are teachers that have done things so bad. They are so bad at teaching, and you cannot fire them, that they show up every day to a location off-site, outside of the school, to this building. They play cards. They play games from 8 to 4 every day, and they get paid full salary. It is better for the children for them not to show up. These are teachers that have committed sexual assault. These are teachers that have preyed on their children, on their students. These are teachers that are so reckless, they never showed up for a job. They never showed up for work. If I showed you what it takes to fire a teacher in the public education system, it's like the Britannica Encyclopedia. And if you miss one deadline, you miss one date, the whole thing evaporates. You have to restart. It's a five-year process. In fact, the education system, they say to themselves, these administrators that actually want what's best for their kids, it is such a waste of our time to fire this teacher. Let's just relocate them to the rubber room. Then we can focus our time in making sure that more of our kids can read. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of teachers right now in our country that are in rubber rooms receiving full pay and full pension for doing nothing all day long. And if you don't believe me, type in rubber room to Google and you will see documentary after documentary that has put this forward. And I guarantee you, most of you have never heard this before. This should be a pillar issue of the Republican Party. This should be a pillar issue of the conservative movement, because we could win the education argument. We could flatten the Democrats, because there's only one party that receives money from the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association. That's the Democrat Party. They cannot support this issue. They are bought and paid for. Just like how the Democrats are bought by Planned Parenthood, you haven't seen anything yet. They are bought so lock, stock, and barrel by the teacher unions. So what do I believe? Good teachers should be able to be paid more. Bad teachers should be fired. And that parents should have the capacity and the parent trigger to pull their kids out of a failing school and send them to a better school. That tax dollars should follow the child. I believe in a market in education. Competition is a good thing. We should reward innovative principals. We should fire bad ones. That I actually trust black mothers to make really good decisions for their kids. And I trust communities to rise up and say, and take back these schools from the teacher unions and take back responsibility for their communities, because it's not happening today. We can win on this issue. I think we could win a landslide election in 2020, win the House and the Senate like you wouldn't believe. It is the issue that everyone in this room and everyone listening to this podcast has had a personal experience with. Do you know that there's only 30 million people that own firearms in this country? Do you know that there's only about 60 million people that have had a personal encounter with some form of abortion or reproductive decision? Yet almost all 330 million Americans have had some encountering with the public education system. Almost all 330 million people. It is the issue that we can win on, and we can win a majority on going into 2020. So thank you for your question. So.
2020 is going to be the most important election in our nation's history. Again, it's not even close. President Trump and the RNC have already posted record fundraising numbers and assembled an outstanding staff. But now they're asking for your help to build the winning grassroots support network. Text CHARLIE to 80810 and receive official Trump alerts directly to your phone. You'll gain exclusive 2020 updates directly from President Trump himself. Be the first to know when new Trump merchandise is available, and you'll even be able to have your input on key issues to help shape the 2020 campaign. Again, all you have to do is text CHARLIE to CHARLIE to 80810. Look, we all know that the mainstream media will never be honest about President Trump and Republicans. Make sure you're getting your news directly from the source by texting CHARLIE to 80810. Again, be sure to text CHARLIE to 80810 today. This was paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again.
One or two more, because these questions, I'm going longer than I thought, by the way, so sorry, but...
So I know Turning Point USA is committed to winning the culture war, and amongst millennials and the younger generation, they get most of their information from social media and pop culture. How do you think we can influence the pop culture with conservative ideals to help us win in the 2020 election?
Such a great question. Thank you. And you put on a great event at Arizona State. You really did a great job. Your whole team, anyone else from ASU that helped put on that event, you guys were so great. It was one of the best events that we did. It was packed to the brim. I think we have well over 20 million views on the cumulative videos from that. At least that one, great job. It was really great. It was really great. And actually, honestly, one of the best that we did all across the country. And it was just terrific. The energy and the enthusiasm and the focus was really terrific. So this is such an important question. So the left owns culture, but they do so by robbing our country and the entire storytelling industry of the actual stories that have made our country and our culture so great. The conservatives, we conservatives, actually own culture and we don't even realize it. There are three stories that are basically the same story that I bet almost everyone in this room is familiar with. Lord of the Rings, Star Wars, and Harry Potter. They're all the hero's journey. The hero's journey is the story of Western civilization. The hero's journey is the story of the individual. The hero's journey is the story that everyone in this room will go through at some point in their life. Now, mind you, they're all three the same story. You got some form of an estranged orphan raised by their uncle, in a place of innocence or vulnerability, underneath a stairwell, in a shire, or in a desolate planet called Tatooine. They go through some sort of calamity, or they go through some sort of I'm sick of this place type moment, whether it be Luke Skywalker looking at the horizon and he fights with Uncle Ben, or Harry Potter saying that he's making too much noise underneath the stairwell, or Frodo Baggins going to Bilbo saying, can I please come with you, Uncle Bilbo? It's always the uncle, right? And then there's some form of connection to the outside world that then touches them, that attracts them out of that place of innocence. For Harry Potter, it was the form of a letter coming from an owl, inviting him to Hogwarts. For Frodo, it was Uncle Bilbo going on this journey, and he then decides to go with outside of the Shire. Now, at that moment then, the individual is detached from the place of nurture and the place of safety and the place of comfort. So Harry Potter goes off to Hogwarts. And what does he do? He has to find out who he is. Luke Skywalker goes on the Millennium Falcon. He has to find out who he is. So what do? Well, what any person does, they make friends. Think about it. Han Solo, Chewbacca, Pippin and Merry, Aragorn and Legolas. They make friends. That's what all of us have done, right? In those times of innocence, you try to find other people that reflect your values. And so they have these little teams that they create, Ron and Hermione. I think I'm saying that right. Hermione. I've never been able to say that for years. Hermione, Ron. And then there's a figure that comes in that instills the core values and predicts the rest of the story. So for Frodo, that figure came in early. That was Gandalf. Gandalf came in and phrased the entire moral paradigm and essentially said, you are going to have to make some tough decisions. You are going to have to be able to fight yourself. Be careful of the temptation. Be careful because it's really going to attract you. For Luke Skywalker, it was Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? Where he instills these values and these morals within him. For Harry Potter, it was a mixture of a couple different people. It was Albus Dumbledore, who nurtured him and mentored him. And also, what the hell was the guy's name with all the hair? Hagrid. I was going to say Hedwig, but that wasn't right. It was Hagrid. My Harry Potter fans over here are dying. They're dying. Anyway, so they have this team. The values are there. But then what really happens? This is where the hero's journey gets really interesting and exciting. They'll have some confrontation with evil. They'll have some confrontation with the external, whether it be fighting Darth Vader or fighting the Basilisk in the Chamber of Secrets or fighting, you know, Frodo, fighting Gollum and all these different things. But in reality, what the lesson ends up being is the greatest struggle is the struggle within yourself. It's Harry Potter having to deal with the piece of evil that is demarcated on his forehead. It's Luke Skywalker having to juggle the voices in his head about going to the dark side or staying in the light. Or it is Frodo Baggins being tempted to take on the ring and he's going on this journey to destroy it. That's the actual struggle that mattered most, more than any other person or any other evil trying to persecute them. What ends up happening in these final climactic moments is Harry Potter realizes he has to overcome himself to do good. And Luke Skywalker has to overcome himself to do good. And Frodo Baggins has to overcome himself. And of course, they end up being triumphant because if you want to change the world, you have to change yourself. And that is the hero's journey. And that is conservatism, isn't it? That's the individual. and you could see yourself embedded in all of that. Now, it's all basically the same story, but what would be the leftist version of that story today? Luke Skywalker wakes up in Tatooine, and he asks Uncle Ben, he tells Uncle Ben, I think I might be a woman. They understand the rising threat of Darth Vader and the Galactic Empire. So he issues a strongly worded letter asking Darth Vader to stop blowing up planets. Harry Potter gets his note from Hogwarts and immediately reports it to the local police and makes sure Hedwig goes to some form of PETA protection agency, because owls should not be able to fly freely without being in some form of zoo. Harry Potter then decides not to go to Hogwarts, goes to a local community college, decides he becomes a non-binary leftist social justice activist, starts doing an immense amount of marijuana, and that's it. It's over. There's like no climax. There's no journey. It's just being mediocre. It's like these amazing heroic people. Frodo never leaves the Shire. He gets hooked on ale, gains all this weight, never stops smoking the pipe, and just reads about Bilbo coming back and doing the heroism for him. But then he asks Bilbo to redistribute all of his wealth to him, forms a protest in a union for all the pipe smokers, runs for mayor, loses, blames other people, and that's it. This is the left. Their stories suck. We have the stories. This is what they're trying to sell young people. Our story is believe in yourself. Form teams. Make friends. Act good. Act well, I should say. Make good choices. Even better way to say it. And then you can improve the world. Then you can find fulfillment. You can find happiness. You can then pursue things greater than yourself. If you actually play out the left's own worldview, the story would never sell. Ever. That's why they have to. The best-selling movies out there, the best way to sell culture, is they have to co-opt conservative ideas within them to be able to get to blockbuster status. But as soon as they start to get into this ridiculous identity politics garbage, the movies don't sell. People don't want to go and just see Harry Potter form a protest. They want to see him go on a journey and have struggle and have heroism and overcome evil. So we already own culture. We have to define the terms as such. And the great stories that are now defining our generation. I could do a whole show on Game of Thrones if you guys want me to. Are conservative values. The left does not have principles. They only want to pursue power. We have ethics, we have morals, we have values, we have principles, and we have a worldview that is consistent with that which culture can dominate in. I hope one day again, conservatives can tell these stories and then brag about it and then advertise it's actually our worldview that is embedded in the great stories that all of us enjoy. Thank you. One more, and then all of you can help us out to make sure that more people hear this sort of message. You guys enjoying this?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Good. Hello.
Hi, so my name is Rachel. I'm actually from Illinois as well. But my
part.
I'm from Northwest Chicago, a suburb called Crystal Lake.
So I'm from Wheeling.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're right up Route 14.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I know Crystal Lake really well.
I'm glad. I love it there, but I live in Arizona now.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Seems to be a theme.
So my question is, and someone actually said this to me, they said that many democratic socialists see that capitalism is a main proponent of a socialistic society, and they say, therefore, advocates of the free market should support a socialistic economy and or a socialistic society and be a socialist. And I was just wondering what your response to this is.
Can you repeat that? I want to make sure I heard it correctly.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So someone said to me that democratic socialists believe that capitalism is a main proponent of a socialistic society, and therefore advocates of the free market should support socialism. And I just wanted to know what your response to that is.
I don't know any evidence of capitalist thinkers or writers defending socialism, but I think I know what they're saying. So I'm going to make their argument for them. So in the most extrapolated version of communism and Marxism, they believe that we can end up in utopia and that we can end up without a state. I think this is what they're talking about. think, and then I'm going to kind of go backwards. But here's the essence of it. Here's what's so cool about free markets and so cool about capitalism. In a current free market society, which we generally live in a free market society, I wish we lived in a more free market society than we live in, it is possible to live like a socialist and be a socialist in our current society. You can live like the Amish do in Pennsylvania. No one is forcing you to live a certain way in a free market. You can start a kibbutz. No one is preventing the Democrat Socialists of Arizona State from pooling their resources together, buying land in the middle of nowhere, Arizona, sharing all their resources, sharing all their treasure, building a communal house, getting rid of private property. They could be the mayor of their own little place. No one's stopping them from doing that at all. However, for whatever reason, they now want to create a society that would prevent us the way that we want to live. So this road only goes one way. We're cool with people living however they want to live. If you want to live like a socialist, more power to you. In fact, you can do it right now. There are people that live in communes in Vermont right now. Actual communes. In the middle of nowhere. I'm not like on a crusade. We must shut down the – like, I don't care. Go live your best life. It's not harming me. As long as you're not trying to take money or take freedom or take liberty or take my speech away, I have no problem with that. But yet, that's not good enough for the socialists. They don't want to live like socialists. They want to make sure you don't live like capitalists. Think about that. If it was just about them living like socialists, they would actually go do it because they can. They have the freedom to do that. They have the capacity and the liberty to do that. It's not about that. Socialism is much more about hating the rich than helping the poor. Socialism is much more about taking people down instead of lifting people up. So they're much less focused on actually living how they want to live. Instead, they're much, 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 much more concerned about preventing us from living the way we want to live. Now, why is that? Well, it's because they themselves believe that what we are doing is exploiting others. And they themselves, for whatever reason, do not have the belief or the confidence that they could succeed in this market economy. So they're worried about bringing other people down and making sure there aren't as many rich people or wealthy people. Because it is impossible to live the life that you want to live and you want to live and I want to live in a socialist state. For example, in Cuba, you cannot have a house or an apartment over a certain square footage allotment. If you have a successful restaurant, you can't start two. You can't speak critically of the Castro regime or the government or they'll lock you up. These are rules that I would not be okay with. For example, if you started Turning Point Cuba, you would have to only say nice things about the Castro regime. If I started Turning Point Cuba and I had a really powerful branch at one college, I couldn't go to a second college because that wouldn't be fair. If I had Turning Point Cuba and I was successful enough, I wanted a bigger office, they wouldn't be allowed to give it to me because it had to be within the square footage allotment. So all of a sudden, they're telling me how I have to live and they're imposing their values on me. Where right now, I love the fact that Turning Point USA, where we're doing the show right now, has a 13,000 square foot building in Arizona. And we're on 1,400 high school and college campuses across the country. Allow people to flourish however much as they want to, as long as you are not hurting somebody else. It's all voluntary, right? If Turning Point was so bad and people didn't want to join, then people wouldn't do it. They wouldn't start chapters. They wouldn't show up to our events. It's all voluntary. And that's the contradiction, is that the socialist, it is impossible to live the way that we want to live in a social society. Yet, it is not just realistic. You can do it right now to live as a socialist in a capitalist society. We will fight for the freedoms and liberties to allow anyone to live the way they want to live. They will not. They are about control. We are about liberty. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.